It is a large language model that is making sentences in a conversational manner, but it is not actually generative AI in the sense that it is creating something new. Making new sentences based on a large language model may be a generative AI application, or maybe a generative application based on a large language model, but I would not say it is generative AI in the sense that we understand generative models.
Is generative AI the beginning of the end for humans, or perhaps the end of the beginning? Welcome to Tech First. My name is John Kassir. Today we're chatting with a senior research scientist at Intel who's working on generative AI that respects people, that creates capability where there isn't, that keeps, she says, humans at the center. All of this is increasingly important as we wonder about the lessons of the Luddites, if they have some, the concerns of artists, which they do have some, the worries of workers, which always exist. Her name is Ilka Demir. Welcome, Ilka.
Welcome, thank you. That was a dramatic start to the conversation, and I hope it will be a more hopeful future than that.
Excellent. It was very dramatic. Let's talk about your story first. How did you come to be a senior research scientist at Intel?
Just to correct it, I'm a senior staff research scientist. I know it doesn't matter to the whole world, but it matters inside to me, so I'm just saying it that out. Sorry about that.
Okay.
I started my journey. I don't know where to start. Like, if you go to my childhood, I was like playing with like little electronic things. We were doing surgery on electronic things with my dad, and we were like opening them and like, oh, like chips and wires, wow, and then closing them, hopefully not leaving anything outside. I started coding in high school thanks to my senior students and us, because we were like preparing for Olympiads, etc., math Olympiads, etc. Then I did my undergrad in Turkey in Middle East Technical University in computer engineering with a minor in electrical engineering. Then I fell in love with robotics and computer vision and computer graphics due to an internship I did with Swarm Robotics. Then I applied for PhD positions everywhere. And of course, like, US has the best programs, yada, yada, no advertisement. And I got accepted into Purdue. So I did my master's and PhD in computer science in Purdue on generative models, believe it or not. Generative models are not new. They were there at that time. So it's not just like invented a month ago with ChatGPT, and ChatGPT is not even a generative model in my opinion, but anyway, so too much information in one sentence. So my PhD was on different type of generative models, procedural models, and how we can actually extract procedural models from data itself. So it's called proceduralization, and it helps us modelers, animators, users, editors, all of the creators to understand the distribution of data, how it can be an interpretable representation so that you use it to movies, games, everything, like all virtual worlds. After my PhD, during my PhD, I did an internship at Pixar, which I need to mention it because it's the most magical space I have ever been. But then I did a postdoc at Meta. We looked at generative models, we looked at virtual reality, we looked at human understanding. Everything is coming together, right? There was like a little startup experience we did. Then we sold it to the big company. And then I joined Intel. Whew. So much.
Wow. That is quite a journey. Wow.
I know.
Impressive. Overachiever much?
Not really.
I was going to start somewhere else. But I have to start here. I mean, you literally laid it out there. You said in your mind, ChatGPT is not generative AI. Talk about that.
ChatGPT is in the source of it is GPT-3 or GPT-3.5, whatever language model, but it is a large language model that is making sentences in a conversational manner, but it is not actually generative AI in the sense that it is creating something new. Making new sentences based on a large language model may be a generative AI application, or maybe a generative application based on a large language model, but I would not say it is generative AI in the sense that we understand generative models, because Generative models are understanding distribution of data and creating new samples from that data. In terms of ChatGPT, maybe it is too token-based that it is just like rearranging the words in a way that it makes sense. Sometimes it doesn't make sense. Sometimes it's not true and fact-checked. And those are other aspects, sorry. In the correct terms, it is an application based on a large language model.
That's super interesting, actually. And I want to dive into generative AI and how you've worked with that over the years, which seems like it started right at the beginning of your educational career. But what you're basically saying there is that it's not creating new things. It's not really generating something new. It's rearranging words in a way that usually makes some sense, is sometimes wrong. But it's not, it doesn't know what it's doing. It's just doing it.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
Exactly. If we need a better word, you can say it is conversational AI, which is a better term. It's trying to make a conversation without fact-checking and without, of course. But in the traditional sense of generative models, I would not say it's a generative model.
So you've been working with generative AI for a long time. I mean, you've been working on it since your university career. Talk about that journey and where you see it trending.
Yeah, of course. So if you look at the history of generative models, you can even see in 1972, Steiny et al., they have that turtle grammars. I don't know whether you heard about it. Imagine you have a turtle, it is walking, and you have three commands to give it. It's kind of programming and like doing something, but it actually ties to the generative models in a way. So the turtle can go straight, the turtle can go left, the turtle can go right. Those are the three commands. And based on what you say, it actually makes a shape, right? Like left, right, straight, left, right, straight, etc. And this is the base of shape grammars, which is actually another way of a generative model to create shapes. And then, of course, that is the 1970s, right? Like that's very old. And from there, all those automatic processing, automatic content creation, automatic synthetic models are appearing in terms of procedural models or syntax-based models or shape grammars or L systems. These are all traditional generative models that people have been using for years and years and years. Like all those beautiful Marvel movies or all the games, EA games, etc. They have been using procedural models for content creation for so long. Now, what is coming is the deep aspect. Those models were either based on handcrafted features, handcrafted rules, handcrafted grammars. And in terms of proceduralization, which was my PhD, we were actually extracting those rules from the data itself. So that was a machine learning approach, not deep learning approach, but machine learning approach to extract those rules of the world from the existing data. Maybe giving a very simple example, assume you have a building, right? Buildings may have parameters, how many floors, how many windows, is it Bay Area windows or regular windows or maybe oval windows, right? All of these are parameters of the system that is creating that. Now, if you just have the output of that, can you actually infer those parameters, those rules from the data itself? Right? So that you can edit for everything. You can just pull, push, do anything with the data, and then you have the output that you want in 2D, in 3D, in text, maybe, I don't know. So that is the background on the generative models. Now the deep part is coming. So instead of those handcrafted features, handwritten grammars, or machine learning approaches based on clustering or shape understanding or segmentation, can we do it in the deep space? So that is what is changing with generative AI.
So generative AI is just like every other technology. It's been going on and on and on for years, sometimes decades. And then, boom, there's something that catches the public's eye and, whoa, there's a new thing. And it's not really new, but it's a new expression at least. Talk about your feelings around generative AI, because, you said off the top, I hope there's some really positive ways of using generative AI. And of course, there's some negative, right? I mean, I've certainly heard from some artists very vocally that that many of the Midjourneys, the Creative Diffusions, those sorts of things are using their art to create new stuff. And they're worried about that. Others are worried about other aspects. But talk about generative AI and how you see it being used. Is it going to be a net positive or is there some negative aspects?
With every technology comes positives and negatives, and I think overhyping about it is incorrect, but running away from it as it is, as if it is a danger, is also incorrect. So these tools exist as long as we find ways to responsibly develop and responsibly deploy them. So if we just forget about the data set, forget about attribution, forget about artists, styles, etc., and just say that we have this awesome approach that can generate everything, then of course there will be like side effects after the fact, unfortunately, that it is like infringing styles, infringing copyright, like you can see logos of stock images from other places, without giving names, I'm talking, but so in my opinion, all of these aspects should be design choices in the beginning of the process, not after the fact that, oh my God, we did this, let's correct this. And we need to put this responsibility pillar in the beginning, and not only in the beginning, but it may be, it should influence how you design the approach instead of how you patch the approach or how you like close the holes, you know? Like if you make a ship that is not floating at the beginning, however you try to patch it, it will take water, you know? So that's like the data set. If data set is leaking something, you cannot do that. Or if the data set has bias, you cannot do that after the fact. Anyway, so comparing with it with the traditional, maybe my answers are too long, but like, forgive me, I have so much to say.
No, this
probably
is fine. This is super interesting. We're having a conversation. It's real. It's natural. It's all good. Keep going.
Thank you. So comparing it with the traditional generative models, I think the aspect that we are lacking a lot is control. So I keep giving examples from procedural models because I think it is very aligned with how humans are thinking in the creative space. So in procedural models with some interactive components, when you pull something or when you pull a wall with windows on it, the windows replicate. It doesn't become suddenly an elephant or it doesn't suddenly become a car. I'm giving extreme examples, but this is how currently the generation is done with generative AI in the latent space. You walk walk in a latent vector in that manifold, and suddenly the face with a beautiful white lady becomes a eyeglasses young child, for example. And that is probably not intended. It is just, if you go in that direction, that happens because that is the manifold. So there is no control and there is no interpretability on that manifold for the artist to find their way. If there were like knobs and parameters that are saying, like, there are some, I'm not saying there's none, because like those generative models are getting better, so we can actually change lighting, we can change head pose, I'm talking about images, we can change gender, etc. But it's not like they are changing the structure.
It's really hard, actually, because I know some people who are doing a lot of generative AI around images. And they could be spending 2 hours crafting the right input, the right prompt to get what they want. And then it's not even perfect and it's not predictable either. So that is really, really interesting. It's also interesting what you brought up around data sets, right? And avoiding copyright infringement and stuff like that. It's interesting to me because I know artists who are saying, hey, my art has been used there and I'm not okay with that. It's funny because if I look at OpenAI and what they've done with ChatGPT, I've probably written, I think I calculated one time, about 20 million words in my lifetime in various places, lots of places, you know, almost all of them are out on the internet. And so guaranteed, OpenAI has used some of my words in some cases to do some of what they're doing. I'm not worried about it. I've learned from others, I've read from others, and everything that I kind of generatively AI generate in the wetware, not the chips, is influenced and shaded by that. So I'm not too worried about that, but it is an issue. The funny thing, though, is that often innovation happens at the edges, right? You see a project like Midjourney or Creative Diffusion, right? And it happens at the edge. And it's like, it's not a full-on company. It's more like an organization. And they're just proceeding ahead. And it's kind of a damn the torpedoes. We're going full speed. And we're just doing whatever we can. Of course, A company like Intel can't do that. A company like Microsoft, like Google can't do that. A company that has something to lose from a lawsuit can't do that. And a company that wants to use that via API for their products also has to be worried about that as well, because they have legal exposure, correct?
Yes, all of those are so many good topics. I don't know which one to start from.
There's so many. Pick one.
So, in terms of big companies not being able to use it, maybe develop it directly, I agree with some of them that some of the data sets that we are using, some of the data sets that we want to use but we cannot use, etc., are actually more suitable for research in maybe more academic organizations or like, those of us that do research and can actually be experimental in their research. We can also do that. Like big companies can also do that. The problem becomes when it becomes product. So if you have an experimental research POC that is super nice, that produces super nice outputs and like everything is going well, etc., that still doesn't make it a beautiful product. And that doesn't still make it like it will be deployed for the right audience with the right requirements, etc. So I think another layer why such big companies are not really, like, I don't want to say cannot do that, but like are more cautious for doing that, is to find that right audience and deployment and productization path. Because we cannot be as experimental as like normal, like pure research. In pure research,
at least in terms of what you release, yes.
Exactly. I mean, research is all about experiments. And like, even if you are very curious about some little thing that is like producing an output that is not intended, but super like nice discovery, that is fine in the research domain. But when we are taking it from the research, then there are so many other layers that we need to talk about and think about.
That's a great segue, because Intel is doing a number of interesting things in generative AI. Talk about some of the projects you're working on.
Yeah, of course. I lead a team called Trusted Media. And it is basically creating a trustful digital future for all of our digital personas in 2D, 3D, text, speech, whatever you can think of as media content. And in Trusted Media, we focus on three things. So one of them is manipulated content detection, because there has been so much fake data, synthetic data out that most of them come from unreliable resources, used for bad intent, you know, like especially for deepfakes. They have been used for misinformation, for adult content, like all those like evil cases. I call them evil cases. And how we can actually start the battle with these synthetic content from the beginning, from like deepfake detection, for manipulated content detection, etc. The second way is like the next step, right? How can we enable the responsible generative AI, so that we don't block every synthetic content, but we enable the creators with responsible ways. Or if something needs, like maybe for data augmentation, maybe for deepfake with consent, or maybe for privacy enhancement, for anonymization, etc. These can actually be done responsibly, and when done responsibly, they are actually changing lives. I will give some examples. Then the last one is the media provenance. So, okay, we found bad content, we enabled generation of good content. How can we attribute that good content to the original creators? May it be the data set being known for any output of generative AI. How can we actually tie it back to the data set? How can we tie it back to the original creator? Tie it back to the generative model that created that content? Was it done with consent? Is there an edit history, etc.? So all that provenance information, how can we embed all of it into the data itself, so that whoever is using the data will know that, This is Ilke's model. It was trained on this data set. It was done with consent. The model was evaluated for bias, etc. So all of that information comes from the output. So you know that you have the output that, okay, this is a good one. We know who did it. And it's also important for transparency and accountability pillars of responsible AI, right? Because you know how it was done. And you, if you have a problem with it, if there's a problem with it, you know who to go. Now, if I see a deepfake around and it's like, I have no idea who created, how it was created, like who is in this photo, etc., video, etc. So these are the three pillars that we are working in trusted media. And we have many different projects in all of those three trusts.
So many questions that arise from that. Like, how do you do that? Do you have to catalog everything? Is it a DRM-like system in order to say, okay, this was created by so-and-so? Well, how's the metadata encoded? Is the metadata encoded in a way that survives manipulation? So many questions that opens up. We can't address them all right now, but you said you were going to give some examples of what you're doing you're doing in a very positive way. Maybe go there first.
Of course. And I'm taking note of all the questions that you just asked so that I add them to my research agenda. So like,
we're going in the database.
Yeah, they are coming to my research plan. So for provenance, just like DRM that you said, like Intel actually when piracy and et cetera, when content was in danger, Intel actually provided like content protection approaches around like watermarks, around like all the using all the security and privacy principles, and it was actually solved by those initiatives. Now, just similar to content protection, content integrity is at risk with deepfakes and all that synthetic media, mm-hmm. and Intel tries to lead that too. About the standards and how we are doing it for provenance, there is a coalition for content protection and authentication, C2PA. And C2PA brings together the brightest and best minds of many companies, Intel, Adobe, Microsoft, BBC, I guess, of like many, many different industry leaders are coming together there to provide open standards for media provenance. How can we standardize all of these so that all the generative AI outputs, all the actual captured data, or all the data in different modalities like 2D, 3D, speech, etc., are protected and can be authenticated by C2PA. And there are many different ways to create those open technical standards or preserve those technical standards. One way they propose is through blockchain and other approaches in addition to that. But what we want to do is, can we use generative AI itself to embed that information, right? Can we actually change the generative network? So, you know, like if we go to the very basic generative network, generative adversarial networks, right? GANs. Can we go to a GAN and instead of having a generative and discriminator networks trying to play a game with each other, can we integrate a third network into that game who is an authenticator network? So it's a generative, authenticator, discriminator, all trying to create an output which is different from the traditional GAN output, that it is actually authenticated. So the metadata is actually embedded itself. It's either a token, is either the provenance information itself, can it be integrated? Similar to that, we can also exploit the generators. We can inject some layers into that for authentication or for marking it, etc. So these are all the things that we are working on the provenance side.
It seems so hard. It seems like an impossible task, and I'm sure you understand it much deeper than I do. But I could see it working for corporate content. Disney creates something. The BBC creates something. CNN creates something. Fox News creates something. I could see them embedding it. But so much of the world's media happens in the hands of everyday people, and they create something and they shoot something and they share something. And is it true? Is it real? There are markers and detectors for seeing what might be fake. But you know, how would some metadata get encoded with anything that I share that says, okay, it was created here by so-and-so at such time in these conditions? and still enable privacy, which then is another layer here on this all. Sounds really, really challenging and really deep. I mean, like, if you have the solution for it, great. That's wonderful. I'm sure it's really challenging. But I don't see it.
There is no one solution for all to start with. So one way to go is just like you said, like big companies embedding it into their workflow so that their content is actually more protected and known and attributed, etc. But another way to go is to armor the tools that everyday users are using so that whatever tool that they are using, that provenance aspect come directly. Just like assume that the main Stable Diffusion API that you are using actually have that provenance piece, then whoever on the internet is using it needs to attribute, needs to own it, you know, needs to say that, okay, I created that, don't shoot me, you know. Why would we shoot, but...
I get it. Yeah.
So, but again, that comes back to why we have trusted media. So if we had provenance, like if we had that magical provenance that was integrated on all software for capture, for creation, for big companies, etc., then we wouldn't be doing detection, right? So that's why the short-term solution comes from detection of such manipulated content. And then as we shift the, like, as it becomes an everyday use for everyone, then we can actually also use provenance information.
So we'll have to move on because I want to talk about some of the other projects you're working on. But that is an interesting world that we're looking at. If you just think about media literacy classes of 2031, right? Like, you know, how will you know to trust the video that you're watching? It was a month ago or so I saw a tweet, which was Elon Musk. Video speaking sounded like Elon Musk, looked like Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. It wasn't perfect. The lips and everything wasn't perfect, but he was promoting some altcoin, some crypto altcoin, and saying, you know, this will be amazing and incredible and you should buy in and all this. And of course, complete deepfake and nonsense. But it'll be interesting to see how we develop as a culture, as a society, as a world, in a world where that can be created. Let's talk about some of the projects you're working on. You're working on some cool projects, including giving speech to those who don't have it.
Yes. So just one comment on the previous thing. I think I saw that.
Can't let it go, can you?
Now you say deepfake, I need to say something.
It's all good.
I think I saw the Elon Musk video, and we actually run our real-time deepfake detection platform, which is actually real-time. So it's not just like given one video, it gives one answer. It actually processes like frame by frame. So I think it was a hybrid video. So for the frames that it was saying fake with high confidence, like 92 to 98% confidence. And okay, this is fake. Then it was like when the other guy, then it was like, oh, okay, this is real, fake, real with the confidence. So we are quite confident in fake catcher catching all of those cases. Okay, going back to the voice synthesis. So... you know, like I said, like deepfakes or like synthetic content for good is actually impactful when it is done with humans in the center of it, and when it is done with consent. So there is this project called "I Will Always Be Me." I guess it's in the link. So for those that lost their voices due to illnesses, or they are about to lose their voices due to some vocal infection, etc., with their consent, their recordings and voices or like from different places, either they can record them or they can use like their existing data, and that can be synthetic voice for them. And through assistive devices, when they lose their voice, they can actually use their own voice to speak again, not through their mouth, but through assistive devices. And of course, nobody is claiming that like this is as good as using your own voice, but instead of using some robotic voices like this to communicate, they can still be a little bit themselves, closer to themselves maybe. So that is one approach that we are that Intel brought up.
That's really interesting, and it reminds me, because Intel the company that gave Stephen Hawking a voice?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually interviewed another Intel research scientist about that, and it was super interesting how she used predictive AI to help him massively speed up, not typing the letters, and first predicting letters and then predicting whole words and predicting phrases, and by orders of magnitude speeding up how he could speak over time. This is super interesting technology for people who are going to lose their voice. It's awful. So very, very cool. Absolutely. Anything else?
Yes, we have My Face, My Choice. I know, dramatic title.
Yes, very dramatic. Wow.
I am the name mother, so blame me. We have many, 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 many online photos or videos, right? And do we want to be on all of them? I don't think so. Some of them comes from surveillance. Some of them comes from... friends that we don't want to be friends with.
Some of them
with.
Come from our spouses who took a bad photo of us and shared on social media without consent.
Exactly. Some of them, you are just walking in a bar, you are in the background and you don't want to be there, you know? For all of them, you know, there are face crawlers that are collecting all of those faces from internet, from social media, may it be Clearview AI, may it be like social media platforms storing 2 billion face embeddings, etc. So even if we want or not, our faces live there and they are probably associated with our names. We don't know that because we don't even know the photos and where they live. So My Face, My Choice brings contextual integrity to those social media photos. That if you don't want to be in a photo, you are not in a photo, but you are replaced with a quantitatively dissimilar deepfake. So assume that we have this space of all many, many faces. We find the furthest one from your face, which is very dissimilar to your face, and we swap your face with that face. So the expression, the movement, the head pose, the gaze, everything stays the same, but the identity is not there. So that when those, when those face crawlers are trying to associate it with your name, they fail and their search space explodes. So instead of like comparing 2 billion face embeddings, now they are exponentially comparing much, much, much more embeddings. So the faces that are similar to your face are increasing, and it's no longer you. There's no like clear boundary between you and the closest face to your face.
Interesting concept. Very interesting concept. How do you operationalize it? Because I have no control over the security camera that captured my face. And I have no way of saying after the fact that I don't even know that I was captured. But even if I did know, I have no way of saying, hey, take that video, run it through this software. How do I do that?
So there are three. So this is based on access levels and face access models. So the first one is that anytime a photo is about to be shared, and when I say shared, you can think it as a social media platform or like uploading to some platform, like when it is going public, the first choice says that everyone is deepfaked. No one, no face at all. And that is easy case, right? You take the face, you find the
Here's
face.
Here's my team. We're out for dinner and nobody's recognizable. Yes, I got it.
The second one is the uploader chooses it. And this is a little bit, again, like easy concept that like, okay, I want this faces to be as is and this face is that. We don't care. They can be deepfakes. And that is mostly for background faces or like non-friends, etc. The third one is similar to what is currently in social media, right? There's like tag untag operations. So if someone uploads a photo of you, it comes to you and you tag or untag yourself. If you untag yourself, it is still there, but it's not associated with your name visibly. It may be associated with your name invisibly, right? So in that case, when you untag yourself or like when you say, okay, I don't want it, at the publish time, your face is swapped with a deepfake. Now, when you scale it to the whole photos in the internet, we hope that the photo ingestion platforms may be like, I don't know, Twitter or Instagram or whatever like big platform you can think of, they will adopt this, hopefully, and this contextual integrity will become to the platforms. If there's no pressure for these platforms to bring contextual integrity, it will stay like that forever, right? And I think the current legislations are also going towards that, like GDPR and etc. I don't want to mention that. That's not my domain, but that they are forcing all these platforms to actually not collect biometric data, and faces are are digital passports. So if we cannot protect our digital passports, what are we protecting? So I'm not saying especially for My Face, My Choice, but such measures should be forced for protection of our digital passports.
What an insane, crazy world that we are creating, because last week, my wife and I were in Vegas. We went for a hike in Valley of Fire State Park. We took tons of photos, and some of those photos, people, there are other people. And in those cases, their face is, if we want to think about it that way, it's kind of weird even to think about it, is their property, right? It's their identity. It's not our identity, but I own the photo that I took, I think. And so, you know, who owns that? And it, so let's say I upload them to Facebook, and Facebook subscribes to this service, and those faces happen to be in a very, very private database that would never, ever be cracked or hacked in any way, that has all the faces of all the people in the world. And those people get notified, you're in this picture, and they say, no, take me out. And boom, it gets replaced with somebody. And at some level, I don't really care. Here's random person number 5,000,000,033, and it's replaced with random person 5,330,000,000, because you've expanded the namespace, you've expanded the data space of available faces. So in some level, I don't care, but in some level, some of my property theoretically has been altered without my consent, although I probably consented when I uploaded it to the social network in the first place. So many challenges to think about, and so many different organizations that would have to subscribe to this level of technology. Fascinating stuff. We have to call this to, we have to bring this to some kind of end. It is very, very cool. I do want to ask you two more questions briefly. One is, generative AI is massively computationally expensive. As we were talking about in the pre-chat, I did a story recently on Forbes that if Google was to answer all queries as if it was ChatGPT or with that level, that could be $30 to $100 billion in CapEx that it would have to spend for NVIDIA GPUs to make it happen, or other processors. Is there a way to make it computationally less expensive? I know some efforts are around neuromorphic computing, and I know Intel has some work there as well. Any thoughts?
I think neuromorphic computing is getting there, and Intel is like releasing some libraries for public use. But in terms of deep networks and deep learning, I think there are still some unknowns that we need to do more research on to actually bring those different operations to neuromorphic computing. But one step back, like when we, before we are there, is that I think most of those can actually be offloaded to CPU and run CPU inference. So we have, like, Intel has all those AI optimization libraries, like Intel Deep Learning Boost, VNNI, Intel Advanced Matrix Multiplications, AMX, etc. And all of these are actually enabling much, much, much faster inference times. I mentioned real-time defect detection. That is like the most concrete use case, that before it was offline and we were like waiting for frames to be processed and like inferred upon, etc. Now it is real-time thanks to all of these like Intel AI shenanigans. It's running real-time on Xeon, and it's actually running 7 to 2 concurrent detection streams at the same time. So you have just one machine running 7 to 2 of them at the same time. So I think that is at least decreasing the computational costs a little bit. And in terms of generative AI too, so we need to bring those AI optimizations to those other models that are doing maybe a little bit different operations, or maybe implementing a hardware optimized way of diffusion, you know, who knows. So all of them are possible ways that we can reduce those computational costs.
Absolutely. And people are designing their computer chips these days with AI-specific cores that are really, really tightly and closely connected. Makes a ton of sense. Okay, let's land the plane here. Impossible question, but I'm asking somebody who your life is in this space, what does AI look like in 3 to 5 years, Ilka?
So, you know, some people say that those hypes come and go, you know. And I think just before generative AI, we had metaverse. But I think our future and our AI future is looking much more 3D from my perspective. How can we bring all of our experiences to 3D with AI, of course? And like now we are having this talk in 2D with video, but like I want to walk around
to
you.
This is so lame.
Sorry. Yeah. No, I want to like walk and talk with you, or like, you know, like not be bounded by this little frame around me. And
you want the holodeck.
Maybe... Exactly.
You want the holodeck.
I think holodeck is already used. Another company is using holodeck, so I don't want to use that word.
Yes. Okay.
No, I'm kidding. I know it is probably copyrighted to Star Trek. So anyway, Star Trek?
Yes.
I don't know. Okay, yes. Cool. So, and I think like all of these generative AI techniques may be like diffusion models or text-to-3D or text-to-3D video or, you know, like procedural generation or deep procedural generation in 3D. All of them will actually fuel that content creation, because one of the, I think, downsides of Metaverse not like taking up as fast as people wanted is that the 3D content and 3D content generation tools were not, they are there, but they were not there enough so that everyone started creating content. Like just compare how everyone is creating so many videos on TikTok, Instagram, etc., versus how many people are creating 3D content for Metaverse, right? Because the tools are not that accessible and that achievable, etc.
Yes.
So I really hope that our AI future will actually empower all that 3D worlds, virtual and augmented.
You know what you just made me think of? We redo this interview in, I'll say 10 years, because there's some pieces that are hard to replicate, and you'll see them as I talk about it. But we redo this in a decade, and my systems, my processes, wherever they live, whether they're cloud, whether they're local, whether they're in my hand, whether they're on my desk, are producing, generative AI producing, an image of myself that is real-time mapped to some of my motions and some of my lips and eyes and stuff like that. Your systems are doing that too. They're interfacing somewhere. I'm seeing that through my smart glasses, and I'm seeing you in those. So I'm seeing you in the environment, and we've picked, you know, maybe we're doing it on Mars, right? Maybe we're doing it on, you know, in the seas of Ganymede, a mile beneath the surface of the ice. Who knows? We're doing it, you know, in the South Pacific, and it's wonderful and warm and beautiful, whatever. And we're seeing all that stuff. I think that is a likely future. The challenges are probably not so much on the generative side, although that exists. There are some challenges on capture side, although those are largely fixed, but there are real challenges on the display side, making that really work in a format that is portable, light, and powerful, which all of those combat against each other. But this has been fascinating. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot for the capture. I need to name drop, look at Intel Studios and how we created 3D worlds for AR, VR content. And for the small capture devices, check out Beyond. Lovely friends are working there, and they created a super customizable little lightweight device that you can use. And yeah, I love the feature that you just envisioned. I hope my microphone will work at that time.
Have yourself a great day. Thank you.